Jesus Morales v. Sessions. Mr. Goldman?
Good
morning. You may proceed.
In the present matter at issue is accessory to a felony after a fact. Accessory to a felony after a fact is a distinct crime. The categorical approach should apply to this crime. The matter of Rivens, the Board of Immigration Appeals indicated that whether or not a crime involving, whether or not accessory to a felony is a crime involving moral turpitude turns on the underlying offense. The government in this case is arguing that pursuant to Rivens, accessory after the fact, in my case, is a crime involving moral turpitude.
I don't. Before we get to that, didn't you have the burden of proof of showing that it was not a crime against moral turpitude? You had the burden of proof, and regardless of whether the categorical or modified categorical approach applies, didn't you fail to meet your burden? And that kind of short circuits going to the crime of violence analysis?
Your Honor, I believe that my client's entitled to the presumption of least criminalized acts.
Well, he has a burden of proof. How does he overcome his affirmative duty to show more likely than not that it was not a crime of moral turpitude?
Well, I believe that the purpose behind Moncrief was the sake of finality of convictions, and so immigration would not have to relitigate every matter. And I understand that in this court and many, pursuant to Garcia v. Holder in the Tenth Circuit, that my client carries the burden. But that does not mean that he must introduce the facts of every case. That does not mean that he must introduce the evidence submitted at trial. That does not mean that he must create evidence.
Well, you didn't submit any evidence, did you?
I submitted the documentation that I submitted was the judgment and sentence, or the order withholding judgment and the charging document. But the question is, how far can the court go? What documents are permissible for the court to review? And I don't believe any other evidence beyond that should be permissible for the court to review.
Well, whether you succeed or fail, doesn't it turn on whether this statute is divisible or not?
It does. And my position is that the statute is not divisible.
Because if it is divisible, then you do run into the question of burden of proof and Garcia and the idea that if things are inconclusive, you lose, right?
Correct.
Okay, so why don't you talk about why the statute is not divisible?
I recently submitted a 28J letter, but I'd like to start with the jury instructions. The jury instructions on page 18 of the 28J letter recently submitted do not have a blank line to indicate what felony was committed. So there's no jury unanimity required as to the felony committed. And that is a telltale sign, in my opinion, of divisibility, or in this case, lack thereof. So there's really two parts to this argument. The first is that the Idaho accessory conviction does not require an underlying felony. It does not require a specified underlying felony. And that's consistent with the court's recent decision regarding the Colorado theft charge. Now, the words inconclusive, ambiguous, ulterior, underlying, a lot of these words are thrown around. And in some circumstances, I believe that the word ambiguous is appropriate. In Garcia v. Holder, the parties agreed that it was a poorly translated Spanish plea form, and that it was, and that the statute was divisible, and it was unclear because of the lack of legibility. It was unclear whether or not what the intent was, what the mens rea was in that matter. And that's the basis for Garcia v. Holder. It's not that in each and every circumstance that this heavy burden falls with the applicant for cancellation of removal. So what I believe the government is doing is improperly shifting the burden to the appellant. And in
don't you accept the premise that if things are in equipoise, you lose?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If things are in equipoise or inconclusive as to the question of whether cancellation of removal applies, as to whether this is an offense that is subject to a crime of moral turpitude, you lose, right?
I agree.
Okay, then. So you have the burden, right?
Well, then what happens to the least required acts? What happens to the concept of overbroad? That's what I'm failing to comprehend.
Well, look at Garcia, and Garcia dealt with Moncrief, or however you pronounce it, and explained what was going on there. And so, essentially, now we're in a posture of, one, is it divisible or not? And if it is divisible, then I think you're in a bad place, because you don't have any evidence, do you? Beyond the judgment.
But,
so why is it not divisible?
Jury, when I go back to the jury instructions and the notice requirement, the jurors do not have to agree on the underlying felony. And this is the exact situation, just regarding divisibility, forgetting about whether an underlying crime of CIMT should determine whether accessories to CIMT, forgetting about all of that, just narrowing down on the issue. Jimenez v. Sessions, to commit trespass, you have to have an ulterior crime. You have to have a crime that you are going to commit when you get in the car, when you get in the home. Home would be burglary, but when you get in the car, a specific crime that you are intending to commit. This court said that jurors do not need to agree as to that crime. And that is what makes that crime, the ulterior crime, which we can call underlying or whatever else, considering that underlying is the words used in Rivens, but there is no agreement required as to what that crime is. So I don't understand under those circumstances how the statute would be, how the accessory to a felony statute would be divisible when it's the identical situation. The underlying crime does not need to be agreed upon.
So under your approach, any accessory crime involving the Idaho statute would not be a crime involving moral turpitude, right?
Correct, Your Honor, because it's overbroad. In another circumstance, it would perhaps not be overbroad. If you compare it to the felony jury instructions, they're dramatically distinct. The felony jury instructions on page 17 say, to find that a person committed the crime, the defendant knew someone else had already committed the crime of blank. Have to fill in the crime. Now, whether or not a particular instruction would be required by the prosecutor or the defense attorney in that matter as to the election of which crime that is unclear from the jury instruction, but it's a blank line. It requires that a crime be put into place. And part of what's going on here is that Rivens, the case that the court is, the BIA decision that the court is relying on, in Rivens, it is a federal accessory after the fact conviction. It's not a state one. And
why is that material?
Because that charging document specifically, because to charge accessory after the fact in the federal system, you have to specify the underlying felony. You have to. And this is part of the mens rea argument.
So is that what you tried to, is that your purpose in submitting Henning?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's the purpose of submitting that matter.
Okay.
And that's part of it. Sorry.
Well, should we rely on Rivens in our analysis?
Well, I mean, my opinion about Rivens, I don't know. I believe Rivens should be overruled, but that's not really the issue before the court today. The issue before the court is this court would not need to overrule Rivens to find in my favor. Rivens is about a federal accessory to a felony statute. In the text of the decision, they list the charging document. They list the underlying felony of what the person was found guilty of accessory to a felony of. And
they apply the modified categorical approach there, right?
Well, in that matter, they went beyond, arguendo, they were permitted to go beyond the categorical approach because the federal case law requires knowledge of the elements of the underlying felony, which means that knowledge of the underlying felony is required. Right. Jurors have to agree as to the underlying felony.
For you to win, we have to find the statute non-divisible and apply the categorical approach, right? You would agree with that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't any of the felonies, underlying felonies or ulterior offenses, be crimes involving moral turpitude that would be imputed to an accessory like your client?
Accessory is a distinct crime. And, you know, the 28J letter submitted by the government is referring to permission to look through an inchoate crime to arrive at, the level of turpitude or the mens rea of the underlying crime. That is an inchoate crime. It presupposes purpose to commit when you're talking about an inchoate crime. Accessory to a felony, the felony is done. It's completed. And it is truly a distinct crime.
Well, is it an inchoate crime?
It is not.
Okay.
If the court doesn't have any more
questions. One question. On the categorical versus modified categorical, and I'm looking at the Idaho Statute 18-205 as well as the amended information, the charging language only goes to 18-205 subsection 1. How does that bear on the categorical modified categorical question?
Well, I believe that the statute in its entirety, again, the jurors don't have to agree whether it was subsection 1 or 2. But the charging document indicates subsection 1. Nonetheless, that still occurs after the principal's felony is complete. You may
reserve your rebuttal time, sure.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's hear from the government. Mr. George.
Thank you, Your Honor. Matthew George for the Attorney General. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, Judge Holmes, this is an inchoate crime, much like the crimes the Fourth Circuit discussed in Shaw of conspiracy, solicitation, and attempt. This is a statute that relies on other crimes as the underlying the crime that the Fourth Circuit said we need to look through to find the underlying criminal purpose.
In your supplemental authority, you say that embedded, but you don't cite anything to say that this is an inchoate crime. And why is that self-evident that it would be? You conspire to do something, okay, and that creates a crime. There, in this instance, there was a felony already created. Somebody takes an act. Those two things aren't necessarily the same. I mean, and so absent providing me something that would tell me, it's not common sense to me that it is an inchoate crime. So you have any authority that says it is?
Well, I guess the board's authority in matter of Rivens kind of addresses that type of argument, rejects a lot of the case law that was existing prior to that, that said, you recognize, yes, it is somewhat of a distinct crime, but we still need to look to the underlying criminal purpose.
Well, in matter of Rivens, I have not looked at it recently, but it is squares with my memory that was a federal crime, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, the federal crime, it requires you to specify the felony. And so in that situation, what difference does it make? In that case, you did have to know what the felony was. And the thing about matter of Rivens, it's sort of surprising me your opposing counsel wants to overrule it, because as long as this is not divisible, matter of Rivens actually helps him, because the idea is matter of Rivens communicates that you actually, the only way you're going to determine whether it is a crime of moral turpitude is to know what the felony is, right?
Yes,
and
sir.
So the bottom line is, as long as he does, you don't have to know what the felony is under this statute, you lose, right?
I'm not sure that's necessarily correct.
How would that be, since matter of Rivens says, if you don't know what the felony is, you know, then it can't be a crime of moral turpitude. If this is not a divisible crime, there is no felony specified.
Well, I think Rivens is broader than what Your Honor is laying out specifically. It's saying more, we need to know the underlying crime.
And in Rivens, there was a federal offense where that was viable.
Yes.
Here, even if you need to look through and know the underlying crime, why don't we talk about our recent case involving a Colorado statute where we declined to do exactly that?
Well, that's an excellent example, Your Honor. In Jimenez, the court spent an extensive discussion going through the Colorado law that applied in that case. It was also a trespass statute. It was a substantive crime itself. It was not something that sort of relies on an underlying crime like accessory does in Idaho. If you look at the Idaho cases, which is what the court needs to do in this case to determine what actually needs to be charged, what elements are involved, et cetera, et cetera.
Stopping right there, as it relates to the Colorado statute, if you don't have a crime that you were trying to commit when you committed the trespass, then the Colorado statute would not apply, right?
Jimenez involved a Colorado statute. We have an Idaho statute.
I realize that, but the point I'm making is I'm asking you why Jimenez really does not speak to and undercut your position here, because you had an ulterior offense, a relied upon offense, mm-hmm. just as you do here. And in Jimenez, we said that you could not find a crime of moral turpitude in that situation because the statute did not require proof of that ulterior offense was the word used there. So why doesn't that hurt you?
Well, I would agree if the state law ultimately says there is no crime, like this is a purely distinct crime.
It was a distinct crime, but it was a crime that relied upon another crime, right? Why is this not different? Why is this different than that?
Well, in Jimenez, the court concluded that Colorado law did not require Colorado did not, the underlying crime was not an element. And so in terms of divisibility, it was indivisible and therefore overbroad because it could be any crime.
Correct. And if I'm looking at the Idaho jury instruction, pattern jury instruction for Idaho, mm-hmm. for accessory defined, there is nowhere in there that it specifies that you have to know what the felony is. A person who knows a felony was committed, you know, dot, dot, dot.
Right.
And in that situation, there is no reference to the specific felony. So, mapping on the rationale of Rivens, tell me what that tells you.
That's one piece of the analysis in terms of determining the divisibility. I'd like to back up just for a second and say the board didn't apply divisibility analysis here. at least not explicitly. And so if the court is going to say that the accessory statute needs to be divisible, that's something that really needs to go back to the board and have it perform this analysis in the first instance. And the board really applied the more looking through type of analysis in terms of applying matter of Rivens. And so to the extent I'm making a discussion here that's getting in front of the board, please take it as that. And
I know you're still answering his question, but didn't the matter of Silva Trevino in effect supersede the Rivens analysis? Isn't that, and at least our research showed that might be the better framework that should be applied unless the Attorney General changes his mind?
Your Honor, I'm not sure how solid Silva Trevino still is. Many of the circuits that have had a chance to review that have rejected Silva Trevino's approach in the CIMT arena. And so that would have applied perhaps before all of that. I'm not sure exactly what this court's position is on Silva Trevino.
What's the Attorney General's position about what the applicable BIA case is?
Matter of Rivens.
Okay.
Because that's what the board specified here. And so our
position
is...
So we should completely disregard that, Silva?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, yes.
In the proceedings before the board, did the petitioner here, did he give the board an opportunity to treat the statute as divisible?
I suppose you could read the briefings and things that he filed as that. The board chose not to construe them as that.
Well, I don't see why you get a do-over. The whole question is whether he had a chance to do it. And if you had a chance to do it and you chose not to do it, then, we send it back to you to do it in the first instance? I don't see why that necessarily follows. It's an issue of law. And, in fact, we're following the framework. If we do this, we're following the framework of matter of Rivens that the board provided, right?
Well, in matter of Rivens, the board said we look through this accessory crime to the underlying criminal matter.
When that is appropriate, but more to the point, matter of Rivens said that if you don't know what the felony is, you can't prove a CIMT, right?
If we don't know, the board said if we don't know, then petitioner loses because it's his burden.
Well, then framed another way, if you have to know and the petitioner doesn't provide evidence, the petitioner loses. Okay. But in this situation, if the statute is such that it is not divisible, and therefore that you cannot know on the face of it, then it's consistent with Jimenez. Seems to me the board loses, right?
Well, I'm not sure if you're saying the board's analysis is incorrect. In terms of applying matter of Rivens...
No, I'm not saying that. I'm starting with the framework.
Right.
Matter of Rivens involved a federal offense, okay? So you had to know what the offense was. All right, that's a given. So in that situation, it was appropriate to apply a modified categorical approach. It was appropriate to determine whether, in fact, the felony was what was a CIMT or not. My reading of matter of Rivens was, in part, and you can tell me that I'm wrong, but my reading was, in part, what it said was that you cannot, if you're in a, you ultimately have to know what the felony is in one of these statutes, because if you don't know that, then you can't decide whether it's a CIMT or not. Okay. And so in that situation, yes, if the statute has as an element the specification of a felony, and then the petitioner doesn't have proof as to what that felony is, the petitioner loses.
Right.
But if the statute doesn't have as an element the specification of a felony, then what happens then?
Our position is that Rivens took a broader approach. The first level analysis is not getting into a divisibility type of analysis. It's more of determining what the petitioner was convicted of, much like trying to determine the actual statute of conviction. And in terms of looking at what Rivens actually does, it doesn't use the language of a categorical divisibility, that type of approach.
But of course, that rubric, we're bound by that rubric, are we not?
If that's the appropriate rubric, we in terms of matter of Rivens, we're looking at what was petitioner actually convicted of. In the same way, if we had a dispute about what statute was petitioner convicted of, we wouldn't apply a categorical type analysis because we don't know what statute to apply that to. And this is the same type of analysis. We need to determine what statute are we looking at. And so we need to know.
Well, we know broadly what statute we're looking at, right?
Right. But in the same way, in terms of, I know we have a dispute about whether this is inchoate, but in terms of the inchoate crimes, we don't apply a categorical analysis to, say, conspiracy.
I was asking you to give me authority to specify that this is an inchoate crime. We don't have a dispute. If you can give me the authority, then that's fine. That's what I want. But that wasn't evident in your supplemental letter.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
So I'm going to leave that point for another day. But this is more about determining what petitioner was actually convicted of. And that's what Rivens does. It says we need to know this underlying crime as part of the fact of conviction. And so it's not because whether it's an element or whether it needs to be proven, et cetera, we apply this categorical analysis at the very outset. First, we need to know that underlying crime. And that's the statute we apply the categorical analysis to.
Well, the underlying crime here is accessory on its face. So we know what the crime is. And if you look to see whether that's a CMIT, can you tell?
Well, yes, because if you look at the Idaho cases, particularly the one I cited in the 20HA Lampion, that says that the specific underlying felony is relevant to the crime, is an element of the crime. It's not any felony. It must, like in terms of harboring and protecting a felon, that harboring and protecting must relate to the underlying felony.
It must relate to a felony. But where in Lampion does it say you have to specify what that felony is? I'm looking at it right now. Tell me. Where is that language?
In Lampion, I don't have the pin site. I think I did cite it. But the protection must be in relationship to the felony the harboree committed.
Okay. Well, a felony that individual committed, as I read that, what it meant was you have to know that there was a felony. I mean, and did it say that as an element of the offense, you have to know what kind of felony it was?
It did explicitly say that, but no Idaho case does that I was able to find.
Well, that's not helpful to you, is it?
Well, it just means it's unknown. I mean, we just simply don't know. In Jimenez, there was more authoritative Colorado law in terms of determining whether that underlying crime was an element or was a means. Here it's not as authoritative.
Well, if you look at the pattern jury instruction for Idaho, that's pretty darn stark, isn't it? I mean, there is nothing in that that suggests that you have to know what the underlying felony is. It speaks in generic, bland terms about a felony. I mean, if somebody is going to be prosecuted under that offense in Idaho, at least I, as a prosecutor, that's the first place I'm looking to determine what I need to prove, and it's not there, is it?
It's not in the pattern jury instruction. I mean, that's one piece of the analysis, though. If you look at Hauser, Teasley, Lampion, in each of those cases, the underlying felony was charged in the indictment. It was addressed in each of these cases. That suggests that underlying felony is an important piece of this crime. If the Idaho Supreme Court were presented with something like the indictment and conviction in this case where it's simply blank, I mean, what do we do with that? How do we do anything with that? Certainly under the federal statute, how would we sentence?
Well, it's not the federal statute, sort of harkening back to my prosecutor days, I would put stuff in the indictment that was not part of the crime. I mean, you put stuff in the indictment to specify the nature of what exactly happened. I mean, that doesn't tell you anything about whether it's an element of the offense or not. That happens all the time.
Well, reading these Idaho cases, certainly Lampion specifically, the Idaho court is connecting the underlying crime to...
Okay, so is that your strongest case in Lampion?
Yes, Your Honor, Lampion.
Okay.
That's an Idaho Supreme Court.
Would every underlying felony be a crime involving moral turpitude?
It would not, no, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, counsel, your time's expired. We have some rebuttal time left for Mr. Goldman.
It, Your Honor, short of repeating what I've previously argued, I'm not certain that I have much more to say. Does the Court have any further inquiry from me?
What's your view of Lemkin?
Lemkin is a due process case. It was a procedural challenge to the sufficiency of the charging document.
Well, does it say you have to have knowledge of the felony? That's what your opposing counsel just said. What's your response to that?
Well, the
pause is not helpful in this context. Go ahead. What?
I believe that for Lampien, it did not address the knowledge requirement in the way that the government counsel is indicating. And even it's a procedural challenge, and so I don't believe it's on point. But having said that, the jury instruction and the other case law, such as Teasley and Hauser, do not indicate that they require knowledge of the elements of the underlying felony, whereas the federal statute absolutely does. And even following the decision in State v. Lampien, requiring some knowledge of an underlying felony, even assuming that is the case, there is no indication that there, and I apologize, I'm going over time, but this is a very important point. There's no indication in Lampien that a specific felony, that a jury must find a specific felony committed. And this goes back to the procedural challenge involving the sufficiency of the charging document. Charging document's sole purpose is to put the defendant on notice so the defendant is able to properly prepare a defense to a claim.
All right, counsel, your time's expired. Thank you. We appreciate the arguments. They were helpful. Counselor excused, and the case will be submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.